Okay, welcome back. Jeff Sachs here from Web Yeshiva. We're studying Masechet Ta'anit. Apologies for last week having to cancel some. Even in these days when we don't leave the house, there's still times where you can't be on more than one Zoom. See, I mean, technically you can be on. I have been on more than one Zoom at once. You know, you open the computer, you open your phone, nobody knows the difference. But there are certain things that require more active participation, like actually giving the shiur. So I apologize for that. But we left off here at the top of Daf Yud Amud Aleph. We're going to finish up to the Mishnah, and then we'll be done with this as enjoyable as the long Agadic passages are. We have to kind of get back to the heavy lifting of classic Talmudic study, which we will do when we encounter the next Mishnah. But here at the top of Daf Yud Amud Aleph, the Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan. Tanu Rabbanan, of course, introduces a Braita. A Braita, of course, is Tanaitic material not included in the Mishnah. In other words, the rabbis of the Mishnah said all types of things. Much of it got codified into the Mishnah, but there were all types of other teachings that were preserved only orally. That's called a Braita. Braita literally means outside, left out. Left out of the codified Mishnah, and they were preserved orally until they were either codified themselves in what's called the Tosefta, to be differentiated from Tosfot. The commentary on the outside of the outside margin of the page is called the Tosfot. No connection whatsoever to the Tosefta, which is an appendix to the Mishnah, and any teachings of the Tanaim, of the rabbis of the Mishnaic period, that were not codified in the Mishnah, nor written down in the Tosefta, were left as mere oral teachings, which were still very well known to the Amoraim, the rabbis of the Talmudic period, the period following the Mishnah, from around the year 200 to around the year 500 CE, and they very often would quote these oral teachings, these Braitiot, usually introduced with the phrase, Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis of the Mishnah, the Tannaim, Tanu, taught the following teaching. That's just the periodical station identification to remember what the meaning of Tanu Rabbanan is. If it was merely review for you, I apologize. But there's always someone who needs their memory refreshed. Sorry about that. I'm going to turn off the phone. Tanu Rabbanan, Eretz Yisrael Nivret Tchila, V'chol Ha'olam Kulo Nivra Levasof. When God was creating the world, first he formed Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, and then the rest of the planet was kind of formed around it. I don't know if this means the creation of the planet Earth, or if it means the entire cosmos, that when Tohu Vavohu were converted from the raw vacuum of space, the helic material, and started to take form, it starts from Eretz Yisrael and the whole galaxy goes out, or if we're just talking about the planet Earth. But for our purposes, the point being that Eretz Yisrael has prime of place and importance. Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is the Bachor, as it were, the firstborn of all of the Aratzot in the world. How do we know this? Shne'emar, a pasuk in Mishle, in Proverbs, Ad lo asa Eretz vechutzot. It's in chapter 8 of Mishle, wisdom itself, the kind of anthropomorphized personality of wisdom, is speaking, and it says wisdom preceded the creation of the world. Wisdom is a kind of concept and value, in the same way that Chazal have the idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nistakla Beraitu Uvara Alma, that God looked into the Torah and created the world, that the Torah, which doesn't necessarily correspond to the Chamisha Chumshei Torah as we have it, but maybe the kind of abstract notion of Torah, existed or predated creation and served, in fact, as a blueprint of creation, an idea which much hay was made out of in the Kabbalistic writings. So in Mishle, chapter 8, there's this idea of that wisdom, the idea of wisdom, which is, of course, you know, one of the major topics of Mishle, wisdom exists before creation, and the kind of narrative voice of chapter 8 of Mishlei is wisdom herself speaking about her virtues, about her primacy, etc. So she says, she, meaning the feminized, personified chokhmah, wisdom, ad lo asa eretz v'chutzot, etc., before the land and everything outside of the land was created, I was already present. Before the mountains were formed, I was already here. So the pshat of the pasuk, the simple meaning of the pasuk, probably means, eretz probably means like settled land, you know, meaning like places where people live. And chutzot probably means what we call the midbar. Midbar probably means that which is outside. As a matter of fact, I mentioned a moment ago the idea that the Braita is the material left outside of the Mishnah. It's possible, David, you may have corrected me on this in the past, but at least in folk etymology, the idea that Braita and Midbar are connected, they are this idea of like that which is like beyond the borders, that which is outside.
That I believe is a folk etymology, but there are yeah, plenty of other words that come from bar, meaning outside, including the English word or the Spanish word barrio, which is like the outside of the town.
Interesting. But folk etymologies are also okay, because they explain how people thought about language, whether or not it's the way the language actually developed.
It's the drash.
So the pshat of the pasuk means that before, you know, places where people lived, or even, you know, wild places, chokhmah was already there. But the drash on the pasuk, eretz, what's eretz stam? Well, oh, there's David giving us a link. What's eretz stam? Eretz stam means the land. What's the land? Haaretz, not the newspaper. The land of Israel. So eretz is eretz Israel, and chutzot is chutzlaretz. You know, the idea that we have a concept, you know, like in English, we can say that we're at home or we're abroad. Tomorrow, Joe Biden will put his hand on the Bible and take the oath of office. The oath of office for the president is actually quite brief and is actually dictated by the Constitution itself. But other officers, if you watch, you'll see Kamala Harris, when she takes the oath, her oath is quite a bit longer, because that was not constituted by the Constitution. Other officers take oaths that promise that they will fight against enemies, foreign and domestic, right? The idea that there's an idea of domestic, literally at home, like domicile, and foreign, right? But foreign means all types of other things. In English, we don't have a specific word that means, if we're in America, if we're in England, that means everything which is not at home. There's a kind of concept of abroad, right? But abroad just kind of means away. But in the Hebrew, you have an idea of chutz la'aretz, that you can be inside the borders of Eretz Yisrael, which has halachic ramification, like the status of your status as a Jew is changed whether you're on this side of the border or that side of the border. Because if you're in Eretz Yisrael, there are different chiyuvim, there are different obligations that are incumbent upon you. Aside from the potential zechut, the potential merit of just physically being present, of walking arba amot, walking four cubits in the land of Israel versus wandering around chutz la'aretz, the actual presence in the land of Israel constitutes some form of mitzvah. However, God keeps track, you know, like in heaven, when we get up there. Actually, we're going to talk about that in a moment. What I just said is, of course, a metaphor, when we get up there. But when we get up there, there's probably like a meter, you know, like you have an electrical meter that measures how much electricity your house is used. You know, it's like, here we are. I can't wait for my electrical bill. Everybody at home, all day, every day, in the cold, with the heat going, you know, with every computer, every light in the house on. It's, you know, the electric meter is running, spinning fast during these winter corona days. So there's probably a meter in heaven that keeps track of your mitzvot. So there's some mitzvot, you know, that spin really fast. Another mitzvot, they spin rather slowly, but they're still at least spinning in the right direction instead of spinning reverse and taking away merit. You know, they're kind of like low-level mitzvot that are easy to do. And the Mishnah says that, you know, al tia mitzvah kala be'enecha, right? That you should be as zohir b'mitzvah kala kebechamura. You should be as careful about a quote-unquote light mitzvah as with a substantial or heavy mitzvah. But the Mishnah does not indicate for us which are the light and which are the heavy. Even though the Mishnah is aware that there's certain mitzvot that carry greater, or certain averot, certainly, that carry greater penalty. But we don't know which mitzvah is greater and which mitzvah isn't. What's the example that the Rambam gives of a mitzvah kala?
Speaking Hebrew.
Speaking in Lashon HaKodesh is an example of a mitzvah kala. I'm mindful of that, despite the fact that we are conducting these shiurim in English. So being in Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah. I mean, it can't be that every moment you spend in Eretz Yisrael is like the same as, like, you know, saving a human life every minute of the day, every day of the week, every week of the year, every year of your life. But nevertheless, it's still a mitzvah. And the meter runs. So the idea that we have Eretz, and we have Chutz La'aretz, and that there's a halak nafka mina, whether you stand on this or that side of the border, is significant. But the whole idea that we have this concept of Chutz La'aretz is significant. I remember once being at a shiur, and some Zionist rabbi making this point that no other language even has such a concept. To which a fellow from Berlin shouted out, Ausland! Which is, of course, the German term quite cognate with Chutz La'aretz. Aus, out, land. Out, Chutz La'aretz. And in German, you also have the idea, if you are abroad. It's not unique to Hebrew, but the nafka mina, for what it means to be inside or outside of Eretz Yisrael, is special to our tradition. So,
one major difference between, and certainly Germany would be a good example of this, is maybe not the language of the term of Chutz La'aretz, but the concept of a Chutz La'aretz, we are unique in that we, like, what other nation would have a limit to the border? In other words,
all nations.
Even if you want to go as far as the Nile and Euphrates, that's it. We don't go any further than that, and generally we restrict ourselves even further than that. But other nations would be happy to conquer lands if they could, and so Germany would certainly have no problem, even if they had a concept of non-Germany land, they had no problem expanding their borders, which we say our borders come up to a point. We're opposed to imperialism, and
well,
so
I
that's
mean,
why
we
have this concept.
Well, I'm not sure about that, David. But we do have the idea of Milchemet Mitzvah, that with the sanction of the Sanhedrin, the Melech was able to laharchiv agvulot.
But not beyond the Nile and the Euphrates.
Okay. You know, there is an opinion in the Rishonim in Masechet, at the beginning of Masechet Gittin, the Nile is the southern border, and the Euphrates is the northeastern border. But what's the western border of Eretz Yisrael?
Lechor the Mediterranean, huh? Or are you saying it's going to go as far off as...
Lechor the Mediterranean... except, like, what if you, and as if you plant a plant, like, on the shore? I mean, there aren't really plants that grow in sand on the seashore besides seaweed. But how far off, if you have a boat, if you have a rowboat.
Our territorial waters?
No, well, it's related to territorial waters, but it's also related to Kedushat Haaretz. In other words, if you have a pot that's planted, in a boat that's docked on the Mediterranean coast, does the content of that plant have Kedushat Haaretz? What? So, or it does. So there's one shita in the Rishonim that the western border of Eretz Yisrael is infinite. other words, whatever the northern border and whatever the southern border is, right, you draw parallel lines of latitude going out through the Mediterranean. And, I don't know, look on a map. I think that gets you to Virginia. So, like, in theory, this idea would take you, like, across the world, that line. Now, it could be that they were a little unclear on exactly how the world is shaped and how large the world is, and that's actually a topic that's coming up later this evening. But, yes, so it's true. It's true what you said within limits. Eretz Yisrael, the Gemara says, Mashke ota HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'atzmo, v'chol ha'olam kulo al yedei shaliach. God waters the garden of Eretz Yisrael himself, and the rest of the lands are watered by a shaliach, by an emissary, by a messenger, by an angel, by whatever it is. Shene'emar hanotein matar al pnei Eretz, v'sholeach mayim al pnei chutzot. So the same idea that Eretz, that he, God, is notain matar to Eretz, meaning the land of Israel. But all the other lands, the chutzot la'aretz, are done al yedei shaliach. Eretz Yisrael, so if that's the case, you have to wonder, why we're always, I mean, I'm mindful of the fact that I'm saying this on a particularly rainy day here in Eretz Yisrael, but we're not always so lucky. So since HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, waters the grass himself, waters the garden himself, waters Eretz Yisrael himself, we'd like to think he has a green thumb. We'd like to think he takes as good care of Eretz Yisrael as my wife takes care of our backyard. She's always out there pruning and planting and watering and standing there with the garden hose and doing other things. But maybe that's the point. He gives water directly to Eretz Yisrael, but it's a function of our merit. Eretz Yisrael shota meg shamim, v'chol olam kulo bitamtzit. The land of Israel drinks the land. It drinks directly from the geshem, from the rainwater, but the rest of the countries have tamtzit. A tamtzit is kind of like the leftovers, the residue of all of the other, moisture that's around. Now, I mean, you've been to Chutz La'aretz and you've seen the rain. The rain in Chutz La'aretz looks like it comes from the same place as the rain from Eretz Yisrael. So maybe it means that, like, the rain in heaven is there for Eretz Yisrael, and everybody else gets the leftovers from that. It's not exactly clear precisely what the Gemara means. But Shnei Amar Hanotein Matar Al Pnei Aretz, right? God gives rain to the land, meaning Eretz Yisrael. And every place else, if they don't get matar, if they don't get rain, they must be getting something else. They must be getting this tamtzit, this leftover or this residue. Eretz Yisrael shota tchila, v'chol ha'olam kulo v'sof. Eretz Yisrael takes its drink first, gets its portion of rain first, and everything else, and all the other countries get afterwards. Shne'emar hanotein matar al pnei aretz. That first he gives the rain for the land, meaning the land of Israel, and then afterwards he sends it to the chutzot. Mashal adam shemigabel et hagvina. It's comparable to a person who is making cheese. Notel et ha'ochel, u'maniach et ha'psolet. You're like, when you make cheese, you take like the milk, and then you take whatever the enzyme you're using. Like for soft cheese, you can use vinegar, or you can use lemon juice, or something like that. For hard cheese, you use rennet or some equivalent substitute, you know, classically taken from the lining of an animal stomach. And that's the enzyme that changes the milk, that curdles the milk and turns it into cheese. So what happens is that you remember Little Miss Muffet, the curds and the whey thing, it all separates out. And then you take the cheese and, you know, that's the real part. And what's left over is the way or the, you know, just the water that is separated out from it. Meaning that, you know, there's the Ikar and there's the Tafel. Right? You know, we get the good stuff and everybody else gets the leftovers. So Omar Mar. Now the Gemara goes back to an idea that we saw earlier, we saw 2 weeks ago, and now the Gemara wants to re-explore it. Omar Mar. The master asked, Mimatkin Hein Ba'avin. The Gemara had suggested the idea that all the water that comes down from the heaven originated in the oceans. Right? We talked last week about the water cycle. That the water evaporates from the oceans and goes up to the clouds and then comes back down. So the Gemara wanted to know, well, if that's true, how come rainwater isn't salty? So the Gemara said it gets sweetened, meaning it gets desalinated up in the clouds. So the Gemara wants to know, how does that work? Or like, how do we know that? Minole. How do we know this? How do we know that that's the way the rain works? De Omar Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef Omar Rabbi Yochanan K'tiv Cheshchat Mayim Avei Shchakim. That's a pasuk in Tehillim. Cheshchat Mayim, the choshech, the darkness of the water, Avei Shchakim, makes the clouds thick. You know, we'll see momentarily the idea that, you know what a rain cloud looks like, right? The rain cloud is dark. A cloud which is very light and bright and white does not usually contain much water. But the rain clouds are always very dark and gray. And there's a nearly identical pasuk, Chashrat Mayim Avesh Hakim, in Sefer Shmuel Bet, the Chashrat Mayim, the gathering of waters makes the heavens thick, meaning thick with clouds. So you have these two words, chashchat mayim and chashrat mayim. So the Gemara says, shakol kaf ushdei aresh. Take out the kaf and switch it in with the resh. You see, one is chashchat. If you take out the kaf from chashrat and you substitute it with a resh, you get chashrat. V'kri be chachsharat. Like you could put the two words together. Chachsharat sounds like what? Sounds like hechsher. It's a play on words. Now, David, those of you who don't know David have probably figured out by now that he's something of a linguist, which is why we keep relying on his knowledge for these things. This Gemara and similar Gemaras is often used as a proof for the way Chazal spoke Hebrew. You know, it's funny. We don't, you know, like we have no idea. I'm listening now to a course, you know, on the iTunes. They have the iTunes University, which lets you listen to, you know, university courses from Yale and Harvard and whatnot. So I'm listening to a course on the history of the American Revolution with Professor Joanne Friedman. She's very good. I've read a few of her books. And she points out that we have absolutely no idea how the founding generation sounded. Like, what accent did they speak with? At what point did the distinctly American accent, and I don't mean my kind of New Jersey accent, but at what point did a distinctly American accent, so that you wouldn't have no idea that these people were descendants of, you know, folks that had come from Plymouth and London and whatnot, at what point did that develop? It's not at all clear. And it's very difficult, you know, minus ear witness testimony, which obviously we don't have from the 18th century, it's really hard to tell. We have no idea what Abraham Lincoln sounded like almost 100 years later. There are reports of what his voice sounded like. You know, when actors depict Lincoln, they usually do so in a very deep, resonant, sonorous voice because he was so tall. He was the tallest of our presidents. I mean, you know, maybe Trump was taller. He said he was better. But Lincoln was physically a very big man. So we imagine him to have a very deep, sonorous voice. But according to records, people who left a written record of having listened to him, he apparently had a very high voice, right? A very weak voice. It was kind of discordant from what we imagine somebody whose physical bearing looked like that. So Freeman was discussing, we have no idea how the founding generation spoke, how they pronounced words, how the accent developed. We know that people in the North, people in New York, thought that people from Virginia spoke with a funny accent and vice versa. But we're not exactly sure what they were. And it's not at all clear that the New York accent of the 1770s and 80s and 90s bore any resemblance to what today we call a New York accent, which was influenced by waves of immigration that came over at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. What we think of as like a New York accent, a Brooklyn accent, was not the Brooklyn accent of Walt Whitman, who was from Brooklyn in the mid-19th century, right? Walt Whitman spoke with a Brooklyn accent, but it didn't sound anything at all like something you might have heard in a New York mafia movie. I mention this because we have no idea how Chazal pronounced Hebrew. There's speculation, but this idea that this mixed up, mashed up word chashcharat may be an indicator that already in the times of Chazal, the differentiation between the hey and the chet was not so great. Because the play on words here takes a word that begins with the letter chet, which even we non-Taymanim differentiate between a hey and a chet, right? But maybe they didn't pronounce it quite so differently. So maybe the play on words here is that the word is hachsharat, meaning the word that we read from our Gemara, chachsharat, which isn't a word, it doesn't make sense, would have been pronounced by Chazal, at least in this period in the Gemara, as hachsharat, meaning to lahachshir mashu, to render something fit. So that's the play on words here. How does it work? The clouds, there are two psukim about clouds with two nearly identical words. And if you smash the words together, right, chashrat and chashchat into hachsharat. But if the way you pronounce that word is hachsharat, right? Right? Lahachshir. So that's how the cloud works, as this mechonat hachshara, this device which can render salty water sweet. Okay? David, do you have anything to add to that?
I mean, there's certainly evidence that, you know, first of all, the Gemara is it Megillah that we read it? They were about how there were people who couldn't pronounce their Hayes and Chetz properly and they were not allowed to daven and so on. There was some evidence in different parts of it, like in the Galil they did one, the Beit Shan they did different things. Right. So it's possible that was an issue.
But those are cases of people that seem to have a kind of, even like a speech impediment. Here, it seems that, no, this is the way they pronounce the word, right? In other words, that there's certain word plays that only work according to certain traditions of pronunciation, but wouldn't work according to this. This wordplay doesn't work according to the way we pronounce the letter chet. Right? But it's not saying they mispronounced it. No, that was the common pronunciation. You know, think of in our day, if you're speaking about American Hebrew, meaning speakers of Hebrew in the United States, who almost by and large do not, what's the proper word for rolling the resh? There's a word for that in uh, in uh, in linguistics for that the rolling of the resh, you know, which we Americans generally do not do or cannot do. We have a daughter named Ora, O-R-A. So we call her Ora. This drives her insane because her name is Ora. And she thinks it's ridiculous that we call her Ora. Right? But, you know, anybody in America, that's like, that's how you pronounce the word. So imagine a parallel case where, like, a certain play on words only works if you, you know, deliberately, you know, universally, in your community at least, cannot roll your rish.
But by the Amora was lived in Babel also, so maybe this is already like
a
thing about Babel. Right.
Now, earlier, the Gemara had said on Daf Tet Amud Bet, we had started off with this discussion of where the rain comes from. So we saw some machlokas between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Eliezer is the one who said all of the rain comes from the ocean. Rabbi Eliezer's view was a little closer to our idea of the water cycle, that the water gets evaporated from principally from the ocean. The overwhelming majority of water on Earth is housed in the ocean, where it gets salty and it gets evaporated up to the heaven and it gets locked in the clouds. And then when the clouds become saturated, you have rain. Rabbi Yehoshua said, Rabbi Yehoshua is the one who raised the question of, but the water is salty. Rabbi Yehoshua says that no. That the water, the rain, the source of the rain is from the Mayim Elyonim. That there's some kind of of primeval water source. You know, that was part of the creation, that Hashem separated between the Mayim Shem Me'al and the Mayim Shem Mitachat, and that there's this reservoir of water up in heaven, and that's where the rain comes from. And he had this whole idea of how the clouds serve as a kind of colander, a sieve, through which that water passes. The clouds become saturated from water above, and then it passes through the clouds down to earth. So now the Gemara goes back and says, Rabbi Yehoshua, who thinks the water comes from... Here. Rabbi Yehoshua, who thinks that the waters come from the upper reservoirs, Bahai Krei Madarish Bahu. So these psukim about Hashrat Mayim and Hashchat Mayim, which are all answering the question of how the water from the ocean goes through the cycle and gets desalinated and comes back down, he Bechlal doesn't think the water comes from the ocean. So what does he do with these psukim that, when mashed together, give you the patent for creating a water desalination cloud? What does he do? He doesn't think that's where the water comes from. So my darish bahu, what does he do? Savar la kiha. So he thinks the following. Dechi'ata ravdimi amar, omri b'maraba, nahor ananei zirin mohi. If you have bright clouds, if you have white clouds, if you have clouds that aren't gray and dark, they have very little water. Chashoch ananei sagyan mohi. But when the clouds are dark and gray, that's when they're full of water. That's when they create. It's not about, these two psukim should not be mashed together, right? They should not be explaining how to take salt out of ocean water. They're two different psukim. One is talking about, one is chashchat mayim, choshech, dark clouds, those are rain clouds. And chasrat mayim is talking about nice, fluffy, white clouds that don't have water in them. I mean, the real reason, you know, a rain cloud, like if you see like those nice there are names for all that. I showed you that picture the other day of the different cloud formations. But, you know, like those kind of wispy clouds, they're bright white, right? They have no...
Cirrus
clouds. They have no rainwater in them. I mean, all clouds have some form of vapor, but they're not holding rainwater. But rain clouds, those big, puffy, billowous, dark clouds, they look dark because a rain cloud has a lot of height, right? Vertically, they're much higher. And that's how they hold all of the water crystals and all of the other moisture. And because it gets thickened with all of the content, all of the water content and the vapor and the ice crystals and other things, that's why it looks dark. That's why a rain cloud looks dark and gray. So, keman azla hadetanya. So, in the following brisa, whose opinion does it follow? The following brisa we're about to introduce, whose opinion is it? The brisa says, mayim ha'elyonim b'ma'amar heim tluyim. Those upper waters, they are held up by the word of God. Right? They are there, they're suspended by the ma'amar, the word, the spoken word of God. Uferotehem megshamim. And their quote unquote fruits are the rainwater. Meaning the if you imagine like the clouds are like the trees, and the fruit of the tree is the rainwater that gets sent. Shne'emar mipri ma'asecha tisba ha'aretz. The whole pasuk in this is a pasuk in Borchi Nafshi in Tehillim Perek Kuf Dalet 104. The mizmor that we say on Rosh Chodesh, which by and large is a description of the natural world, of the greatness, of the majesty of the natural world. So the whole pasuk is Mashke Harim Ma'aliyotav Mipri Masecha Tizba Haaretz. It would have been, in this case, the whole pasuk is really necessary. But you know, Chazal figured that, you know, the whole Tehillim and the whole Torah and the whole Tanakh by heart, they don't need, anybody watch Shtisel? You know, so Shtisel, you see this perfectly. The way they speak, particularly Shulam Shtisel, where every other sentence is a half pasuk, right? Worn in, right? Because he figures, you know, like he says, somebody asks him a question, and he says, oh, we have no way to know. He says, ma anachnu yodim? Lo machshev osai machshev oseichem v'chu. Right? In other words, that's a pasuk, right, from Yeshayahu, right, that our Hashem's way of understanding is not like our way of understanding. V'lo darchechem derachai, and the way of God's operating is completely foreign to the way of the way that we operate. Meaning, we exist on different planes. We have limited ability to understand how God runs the world. So Reb Shulam says, "Ma anachnid? What do we know? Lo machshavos sayvachu." You know, like you're meant to fill in the pasuk for the rest. That's a very Talmudic way of reasoning, right? The Shtisel got it from the Gemara, not the other way around. So here, the whole pasuk, Mashke Harim Me'aliyotav, God waters the mountaintops from the water that's held up, Me'aliyotav, up in the higher heavens. And the Perot, the Pri, Ma'asecha Tizba Ha'aretz. And the fruits of His deeds will satisfy the land. Kiman, so whose opinion is that? Obviously, that's Rabbi Yoshua, right? Why? Because Rabbi Yoshua says, where does the water come from? From the upper reservoirs. This pasuk is a pretty good proof text for him. So, Rabbi Eliezer, what does he do with that pasuk? He says the water comes from the ocean. So what's it talking? There's an explicit verse in Tehillim that talks about the water coming from the Ma'aliyotav, the upper reservoirs. So what does he say? What does Rabbi Eliezer say? Is Ahahu b'maasei yadav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu dichtiv? No, that's talking about maaseh bereshit. Of course, the water all originally came from the upper realm, but once the main waters came down here and populated the mikveh mayim, the ocean and the lakes and the whatnot. So then it begins this begins this cycle. But he does not deny that the initial watering of the earth came from above. So Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. The Gemara says, hold on. Oh, wait, there was one thing I wanted to point out, which is fascinating. Earlier we had said this idea that the Gemara had said the idea that Eretz Yisrael takes the drink of rain first, and then all of the other lands get their drink. So Rashi says b'tchilas shota that the Eretz Yisrael takes the first portion of rain. Sham yordim hagshamim tchila. When it rains, it first rains in Eretz Yisrael, and then the rain goes everywhere else. This is a little difficult to understand, because clearly that's not how meteorology works. It can't be, and this Gemara cannot be understood as correlating on its surface level with any contemporary meteorological understanding. And Rashi says, "Sham yodim agshamim tchila, kach shamati," or at least that's what I've heard. Right? Where did Rashi get his information? Where did he get his weather report about what's happening in Eretz Yisrael? Not from Barry Lynn, our friend and neighbor here, who's stuck his neck out once again by calling for possible snowfall in Gush Etzion tomorrow night. He's been wrong more than he's been right. But there's a great subject of debate. If it should snow here in Efrat tomorrow night, should there be a snow day on Wednesday? In a world of Zoom school, do you get a snow day anyway or not? I think Oded Ravivi would risk his re-election campaign if he doesn't call school off for a snow day, even during Zoom school. The Gemara goes on, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, Omer b'Yeshua ben Levi, kol ha'olam kulo mitamtzit gan Eden hu shote.
It's very theological, actually, isn't it? Allegorical.
About Gan Eden?
And about the rain, yes. You can put both the same together, really.
Yeah, I think so. I think the whole thing is, you know, this whole piece of Agadah is. I mean, it certainly can't be understood on its simple meaning.
Exactly, of course not.
So, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, kol ha'olam kulo mitamtzit gan Eden hu shote. That our rain is somehow distilled from the waters of Eden. Okay, whatever that means. Shene'emar v'nahar yotze me'eden. Right, the beginning of Sefer Bereshit, it describes this river going out from Eden and then breaking up into four different rivers, the four different, you know, major rivers of the ancient world. Tana mitamtsit beit kor shote tarkav. Now from here, the Gemara gets into a rather technical discussion from which you can determine something about Talmudic geography, of how they understood the proportion and the size of the world. A Beit Kor is a measure of land in which you can plant a kor, a volume of certain seeds. In other words, you have to, when you're planting your seeds, right, you have to spread them out. If you put a whole basket of seeds in one little patch of earth, they'll all die because there won't be enough land to support the growth of each seedling. So when you're planting wheat for a core for this volume of seeds, you need land of a certain size. That's called a bait core. A bait core is 75,000 square amot. It's about 18, 20 acres or so. 18 or 20 acres. It's a little more than one square mile. Little more than 1 square mile. Does anybody speak acres? Does anyone know what an acre is? Right? I mean, I remember in America people talking about, oh, they had a house that sat on a quarter acre of property. But it didn't.
I remember that Golden Gate Park was around 1,000 acres. That's my... And Central Park's probably around the same size.
1,000 acres. So this is about 20 acres. So 20 into 1,000 is...
50?
Right, there's 1/50th the size of Golden Gate Park or Central Park is a bait core. I mean, if that means something to someone. So a bait core, mitamtzit bait core, shote tarkav. A tarkav is another size of property, which is 1/60th of a bait kav. Meaning, when you water the bait kav, when you water this 20-acre plot of crop, there's going to be a certain amount of runoff of water, right? You know, because not all the water can be absorbed in the land. And there's going to be a certain amount of runoff. So the runoff of properly watering a bait kav, a 20-acre plot of land, is going to be enough to water an additional plot of land that is 1/60th the size of the land. In other words, in order to water a piece of land properly, you have to overwater it a bit. You don't want to overwater it too much, because overwatering can do as much damage. But in order for, under average conditions, not conditions of drought and not conditions of flood, but in average conditions, in order to water that larger size property enough, there's going to be enough runoff that you have to factor in a spillover of 1/60th of the amount of water that you use. That's the mathematics of what this concept means, that to water a bait core, you're going to have enough extra water to water a tarkav. Okay? This idea of this ratio of an extra 1/60th of water. So Tanura Banan. Eretz Mitzrayim havya arba me'ot parsa al arba me'ot parsa. The land of Egypt was 400 parsot by 400 parsot. A parsa is about 2.7 miles or 4.3 kilometers. So the borders of Egypt were 400 by 400, meaning about 1,100 square miles. This doesn't seem to be right. I mean, even though obviously ancient Egypt was not coterminous with the borders of what today we call Egypt, but it seems to be a little bit on the small side. But let's take it for granted. Cush was a much larger country that bordered Egypt. As a matter of fact, there was a very nice Dvar Torah this week in the Shul email about the frogs and Mitzrayim and Cush and the borders. And if you listen to it, you heard my son talk about it on the video drasha from the Shul this week. So the Gemara says that the borders of Egypt were 400 by 400 parsot. Vahu echad mishishim mikush. The size of Egypt was 1/60th the size of Cush. Cush is kind of like everything in Africa south of Egypt. And Kush, echad mishishim ba'olam. The area of the country or the land called Kush was 1/60th of the entire earth. So Kush, I mean, just by comparison, according to these measurements, if our calculations of what a parsa is more or less correct, Mitzrayim would be about 1,100 square miles. How many square miles are there today just in the little state of Israel? Does anyone know? It's about 8,000. There's about 8,000 square miles today just in the state of Israel. So you understand why the idea that all of Mitzrayim, which again was not the entirety of the country today, Egypt, contemporary Egypt, is I think almost 400,000 square miles.
But if they were, you know, around the, I mean, I guess this is a drasha, but if they were around the area of the Nile, I imagine the most people lived around the Nile, I assume.
Yes, but
so in which case, much smaller than.
Yeah. Obviously much smaller, but not 400 times smaller, right? From 1,000 square miles to 400,000 square miles. Anyway, lo chashuv. So the idea that Egypt is 1/60th of Kush, and Kush is 1/60th of the whole landmass of the earth. Ve'olam echad mishishim bagan. And the landmass of the earth is 1/60th of the Garden of Eden. Vegan Eden mishishim vegan. I'm sorry. One 1/60th of the garden which was in Eden, and the garden was echad mishishim le'Eden. Right. In other words, Gan Eden is a place within Eden. Now, first of all, this Agadah makes it seem like what? That Gan Eden is not on this earth. Right? Because we're talking about the landmass of earth relative to Gan Eden, and Gan Eden relative to Eden. The Eden echad mishishim legehenom. Nimtza kol ha'olam kulau kekisui kadeira legehenom. Mitzrayim is 1/60th of Kush, and Kush is 1/60th of the world, and the world is 1/60th of the size of the garden which was in Eden, and that garden is 1/60th of the entire of Eden, and Eden is 1/60th of Gehenom, and of Gehenom, so that the whole earth is just like the pot is the lid on Gehenom, right? In other words, the surface area of a pot relative to a pot and maybe all of its boiling contents, which are hell, gives you some kind of sense of proportion between the two. V'yeshomrim Gehenom ein la shi'ur. And some say that Gehenom has no measurement. V'yeshomrim Eden ein lo shi'ur. Now, what can that mean, ein lo shi'ur? It has no set measurement. I mean, it might mean that the Gemara is saying that the idea of Eden, not to be confused with the physical place where Adam and Eve actually lived, right? But the idea of kind of Gan Eden, not as the origins of creation, but as like the end point of existence. Maybe those are kind of not theoretical, abstract constructs, right? Gehenom and Gan Eden, but that they have no actual, you know, physical measurements that correspond. Just like the idea that the Olam Haba, which at least according to the Rambam's position, is different than the Olam Hatchia. The Olam HaTchiyah, after there'll be resurrection of the dead, we will repopulate this earth, the earth in which we live. And aside from the fact that we'll be interacting with people that had been long gone, had been brought back, it will be a rather natural existence. People will eat, and they'll drink, and they'll live, and they'll die. And then the disembodied soul goes to Olam Haba. For the Rambam, this is a very important distinction. And the Olam Haba is completely non-corporeal. Since it's non-corporeal, there's no physical aspect to it. So it doesn't exist in place, and it doesn't exist in time. Right? So maybe that's what the Gemara is hinting at. Now the Gemara wraps it up. You know, the Zagadah really has almost come off the train has almost come off the tracks. Omer Rabbi Oshaya, my dichtiv, what is the meaning of the pasuk in Yirmiyahu? Shachant al mayim rabim rabat otzarot. A pasuk that's describing Bavel, that says that Bavel sits on many waters, and it has many great otzrot, many great storehouses. Mi gram la Bavel shiu otzroteha mleot bar. So why is Bavel blessed with storehouses full of grain? Have Omer mipnei sheshochenet mayim al mayim rabim. Since Bavel sits between these two great mighty rivers, since Bavel, unlike Eretz Yisrael, never has to worry about water supply. There's always water to irrigate crops. You can go years without rain and not worry from drought and not worry of dying because people don't have potable water to drink because they have these rivers. The rivers, the non-ending Tigris and Euphrates, fresh water delivered daily to water your crops and to quench your thirst, right? This is the source of the wealth of Bavel, because again, wealth, the gross domestic product, the stock market of any country is directly connected to water supply. And if you don't have to worry about the vagaries of the weather and the rain, and you have this steady flow of the Nile or of the Tigris of the Euphrates, well, then you're in the money. You don't have to worry about it. Because Bavel sits on these Mayim Rabim, that's why their storehouses are always full of grain. Have Omer mipnei sheshochenet al Mayim Rabim. Omar Rav Atira Bavel dechatzta belo mitra. The wealth of the nation, the wealth of Bavel, is on account of the fact that it can grow crops below Mitra without rain. Their crops, their agriculture, their economy is not dependent upon the vicissitudes of rain and the weather. Omar Abaye, Nektinan Tovane, Velo Yovshane. So Abaye says, it's better to be tovane, to be damp and swampy, than to be yovshane, to be dried up. Right? All things being equal, it's better for your crops to be in a swamp than to be in a dried out type. It's better to be near water than far away from water. That's the best way to have success as a farmer. And that's the end of this long Haggadah. The Mishnah now turns its attention to more prosaic matters, like when do we start saying Mashiv HaRuach Omorid Hagoshem, when do we start saying V'tein Talu Matar Levracha, the adjustments that we make to the Amidah in order to ask for rain, and that's where we will pick up next week. Get your vaccines. Stay healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you.